Sarah Bauman, managing director of Jungle the Wild. The Wild by Jungle.
The Wild by Jungle.
Already. I am killing this. I am murdering this. So I like to think about you as a LinkedIn profile to kind of just to give people an awareness of who you are and where you came from. So you began your life at Leo Burnett, I believe. Straight in, account, client services background, Artelier. We'll get into this in a second. 16 years at Leo Burnett. That is one of the longest stints I've ever asked somebody about on this podcast. Then you left and you went to VaynerMedia, which I really want to get into. There was a hiatus in between. There was a moment where you were Brexiteering and it was anti-Brexiteering. Yes, and yeah. I want to speak about that as well. And now you're in your new role. Before we go into your roles and what you've learned, I'm going to ask my question, which is, who was the first person that made you feel talented?
Ooh, that's a good question. I presume this is excluding my parents.
No, you can say your parents.
Well, they were very good, but obviously parents do make you feel very talented and wonderful, probably too talented and wonderful. But if I think about when I got into the world of work, I actually did a brief couple of years at Wunderman Thompson, which was then JWT, before I went to Leo's. Yeah. And that's probably quite significant because the first time I did actually feel talented and valued or recognized or that I had anything was at Leo Burnett. And I think if I look back, A, I was probably partying too much and having too much fun. But B, I just don't think I'd really read the world of work and I hadn't read the politics and I hadn't really understood that you actually had to proactively, politically go out and sell yourself to, you know, your head of department or whatever, which again, sort of one of the reasons I decided I wasn't going to stay kind of for too long, kind of at my first agency and my first role. And then it was quite early on to my time at Leo Burnett when I was an account director on McDonald's. I had two amazing people actually who made me feel very kind of talented and valued. And one was my strategy director on McDonald's and the other was my head of account management, who I then also went to work into on Fiat as well. And both of those were amazingly talented, outspoken, confident kind of senior women. And it was the first time anyone had actually said, oh my God, you're good at this, and actually actively tried to manage me into situations where I could do better and where I could learn from them, kind of as we worked as well. Wow. And I'm still friends with them both. I love them to death.
Do you remember what you did? Because what was that? That was a client services role. So you would have, how did you know about this? So before you ended up at Wunderman Thompson, or Wunderman, they would have been called.
Yeah.
Then. How did you get into this world? What was the kind of, how was it positioned?
Well, this is a good story, actually, because it was kind of by chance and kind of by design. So I went through university sort of not thinking too much about what I was going to do. I knew what I didn't want to do. I knew I didn't want a very formal corporate job. I wasn't going to do law. I wasn't going to do accountancy or consultancy or any of those sort of proper jobs, because also I would have been really bad at them. And I knew I wanted to either do something in the sort of the realm of creative business, but that could have been production, it could have been advertising. And then my mum, really bizarrely, having made me feel very talented and clever all my life, then turned around and said, I really think you ought to learn how to type and do a secretarial course. I was like, what? She was like, you will never ever be out of work if you know how to type. And I think she'd seen so many awful recessions and people losing their jobs and young people struggling to find work. She literally packaged me off. My mother was quite sort of a strong woman. So packaged me off to kind of secretarial college where I was with other grads and we all were really confused as to what we were all doing there and learning how to type. But they had a really great kind of careers service and they managed to get me my temp job at JWT. So I went into JWT as a temp and receptionist and I worked there for kind of 2 months, I guess, and decided, well, this is like a complete gift because I can actually weasel my way onto the grad scheme without having to do the grad scheme. So that's what I did. I kind of went in through the back door and got to know people and put myself forward and then managed to get a role as a grad trainee. And yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Quite an unusual way.
That is a weird way.
Yeah.
I also didn't think type school was a thing anymore. Like that
shows how old I am. But
well, I mean, you're
probably
not like 90. So I just imagine that to be quite a post-war thing.
It was mental. It was really mental.
That is, I mean, it's the equivalent of like your mum said, you need to go learn how to sew.
Yeah, it was. They made us learn on actual typewriters as well, which I didn't think existed anymore. So you could get the real feel of the letters.
This isn't real.
But we're like, but there are laptops and computers. Yeah. Why are we learning on this strange machine kind of thing? It's so strange.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Then Leo Burnett. And so it was Atelier, which from what I remember was the fashion luxury kind of arm of Leo Burnett. But you began on McDonald's. How does somebody go from McDonald's to Lux and fashion? They're like, I like how you sold that cheeseburger ad. Do you do necklaces as well?
It was, I guess if you're there long enough, you can kind of do anything. And I think it was, Leo Burnett at the time was, still is a really interesting business, obviously doing phenomenally well right now. But at the time, it's very different in terms of shape and structure. And one of our core clients was Procter & Gamble. Mm. And we did all of their sort of beauty and hair brands as well. So we had this really big kind of center of excellence around kind of around beauty and skincare and that kind of sector, which obviously requires a very different creative approach and strategic approach to McDonald's or, even kind of Procter & Gamble laundry and all of the great work we did for that. And that said, a lot of the principles of, running a business well, looking after your people, winning new clients and kind of reshaping towards a different agenda were kind of very similar skills to what I had been doing in the main Leo Burnett agency as well. But it was a challenge. Mm. And I had to kind of convince also a lot of people within the business that I could make this transition. Yeah. And, not just in terms of, can you credibly go from a McDonald's or a Littlewoods, as we were doing at the time as well, to suddenly, pitching the Outnet and, Vitamin Water and all these very, very cool brands at the time. But you have to sort of show that you understand the different form of communications as well. And the fact that if you're going about answering a brief for, a very, very luxury kind of fashion brand, how does that differ to a kind of more classic strategic and advertising approach as well? So, I just jumped at it because, how often do you get the chance to move from such a mainstream sector into such a specialized and different kind of agency? And it was also very different in feel because it was kind of our boutique arm within kind of the Leo Burnett group, which was huge at that time. We probably had about 300-400 people, and then Atelier was this gorgeous team of probably around sort of 40-50. So it's very, very different in terms of vibe.
So you almost did two companies in one then. Yeah. Or like in a weird way, three, because you went, so Leo Burnett, Atelier, but then you became deputy CEO at Leo Burnett.
Yes.
What was that about? Was there, before you answer that actually, when were you happiest? If you remember your time there, was there a year, was there an account, was there a gang of people where you were like, this is the best, it's not going to get better than this?
That is such a hard question to answer.
You won't offend anybody, I don't
think. No, but one of the reasons I did stay at Leo's for so long was because there were so many times when I felt happy and excited and it all felt new and fresh and different. But if I look for any themes, I think working on the McDonald's account was absolutely amazing.
Really?
Absolutely amazing.
Why?
A, because of the value of creativity
from McDonald's.
McDonald's, from the agency, and just this shared goal to actually make the best work that you possibly can and the best work that actually affects a result.
Yeah.
But I think there's also something which I've learned about myself over the past few years is, when things are fast paced, when there's a lot of adrenaline, when things aren't always kind of, easy or straightforward, that actually creates the most amazing team spirit.
Yeah.
And it's why I love pitching as well. And I think my other happiest times at Leo's and Atelier were when we were pitching as well, because, again, you just get this incredible sense of unity and shared ambition.
Yeah.
And everyone feeds off that energy. And I really love that.
So that's quite a lot about your preference in work, because I can imagine, where does that go? Because Or better question would be, when does it get boring? Or what's the inverse of that? So when you're like, oh, this is what, do you remember when you felt drained or when in a moment, what kind of comes up when you're thinking about feeling like, oh, Jesus Christ, that was a bad time?
I think you have to build in those, the moments of downtime, which I think gets harder and harder because, you know, when you're doing big pitches, you always have that period afterwards when it's like, oh my God, what do I do with an evening now? Yeah. I'm kind of, I can go home before it's dark. I haven't seen daylight for 4 weeks. And then you have just that bit of time afterwards to just get your life back, rehabilitate, kind of, yeah, catch up on your sleep, your friends, your family and everything. I think what is more challenging for everybody in work now, and I was talking about this the other week with somebody who literally, they're about sort of, I don't know, 15 of us at a Wackle kind of drinks thing the other week, where we're just saying, are there jobs where there are peaks and troughs anymore? Because none of us could really think of any, because everybody is driven by such kind of intense kind of performance and goals and achievement. And obviously the fact that we're always on, we're always available. I think it puts more onus on individuals to try and create that kind of downtime as well. And we read so much about burnout and everything now. It's such a big theme. I think that's the danger. If you don't manage yourself, and if I don't manage myself to make sure I'm, just not getting too carried away, because I get very optimistic. I get very enthusiastic about things. So it's always like, oh, the next new shiny thing, new opportunity. Let's do that.
So you're saying that it's the peak. It used to be more up and down. Like,
I think so.
You'd rally around a pitch and it would be not McDonald's, but it'll be a thing at Leo Burnett that you're pitching for. Littlewoods. And then Littlewoods, I've not said that for so long. And Laradute. You're pitching for them both at the same time. So you're pitching for Little, and then you're gonna, you know, everyone just goes back and they chill. Are you saying that now that doesn't really happen as much?
Well, I can't speak for all agencies. I do think there's probably also a shift, obviously, into my world, because I've moved from that sort of big mainstream network creative agency into, you know, unashamedly fast moving, very, very kind of social and digital agencies. So I think there is something about the nature of social as well, where obviously you never launch a campaign and sit back. You know, you're always there thinking about, you know, how to drive engagement, how your content's performing, what's next kind of thing. So I think it gives a different shape to it for sure.
How did that happen to you then? Because, you know, Leo Burnett, traditional agency, okay, I'll tell you, I can imagine the work probably was a bit more digitally skewed, if it's fashion brands and websites and that kind of stuff. What, why and how did you then end up at VaynerMedia? What was
another very good question and a bit of a quirky answer on that one as well. So I think my time at Atelier was really, really pivotal in this, because as you say, we did shift a lot towards digital and social in that, partly because a lot of our clients didn't have budget for big TV campaigns. So by necessity, they were like, what can we do? How can we do this differently? But also because it was that moment in time where actually social was becoming huge and you could do so much, and we just jumped into it. And then I realized I loved it. And actually it was really exciting. And I loved the kind of the unpredictability of it, the messiness, the fact it was always changing and always evolving. So when I left Leo's, I'd sort of made the decision. It was really hard because I loved it so much. And obviously I'd had a great role there. I was deputy CEO. It was like, why leave now, Sarah, when, you know, you've finally got to that point after 16 years working your way up. But I realized I had to go and experiment and explore and have some different adventures and different kinds of businesses. And I really wanted to go deep into social and digital. And that was definitely my direction. As you alluded to, there was a little bit of a hiatus in that, and I got very randomly introduced and met the amazing people at what was the People's Vote campaign, who were just starting to organise marches and put pressure on the government, I guess, to get a better Brexit deal is the best way of thinking about it, rather than trying to stop Brexit. And they said to me kind of, we've got a march in a few weeks' time. We haven't really done much, kind of really need somebody who understands advertising and marketing to help. Kind of, have you ever organized a march before? I was like, no. It's like, I've also never really been on a march. No, so, but I'm really up for this. No. So, but I went in initially for kind of 6 to 8 weeks to help do that. Mm. And it was amazing. We thought we were going to get 20,000 people if we were lucky. We got over 100,000 people. Wow. We made it on the news. Suddenly, you know, you had BBC helicopters tracking the march. And from that day on, the movement suddenly took hold and took shape.
Yeah.
And they asked me to stay on and be their marketing director. And I just thought, you know, when am I ever going to get the chance to do anything like this again? No. I mean, it's just not going to come. So, you know, my agency continuation of career can yeah. wait. And that was essential, actually, for me, because not only did I get to work just in a completely different sphere with completely amazing, very, very different people who are all very kind of much from the political world. It got me really, really deep into what I didn't know. Mm. And I'd gone from being, you know, MD, deputy CEO, talking a great kind of game and pitches about kind of social and digital. But I was suddenly faced with, oh, I've got to go in and set up a kind of a Facebook campaign and I've got to do the targeting. And now I'm buying media space from people. And I've been sitting next to the guy who's been crowdfunding and watching people's pounds come in. And I've got to hand over some money to Ooh. A media owner. And I feel really sick because what if it doesn't work? So I was going through all of these different Wow. kind of experiences and emotions. And I think that was an amazingly kind of humbling moment actually Yeah. doing that, which kind of really helped define what I did want to do next. And it made me realize I really, really, really wanted to learn about social from, you know, an agency and people who had some really bold and interesting and very different kind of insight and perspectives yeah. on it, and weren't from kind of the, I guess, the core stable of creative agencies mm. and digital agencies I'd grown up with. So when I started talking to Vayner, I mean, who else could better meet that brief than yeah. than Gary and Vayner?
Okay, and so that, how was that positioned to you? Obviously, you and I were talking at that time, and we had a tiny other agency. I remember, I think I said to you, it was like Brad Pitt versus Hugh Grant. I remember that, and it still couldn't get you interested in my little agency. Fair enough. I think good choice. You know, yeah. that was the good choice, and it would have been completely. You know, you would have learned a whole bunch of different stuff. But how was that positioned to you? And how did it go?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing. I think in the same way as Atelier had been a bit unknown kind of within that sphere, mm. Vayner at the time was known by a relatively small group of people. It's quite new in the UK. I've been here about sort of 3-4 years. Mm. And I think, you know, I was the first local hire. So it was really about how we could try and build the reputation, how we could grow, how we could attract kind of new talent in. Mm. Basically, you know, try and establish Vayner as, you know, a partner for some of the world's biggest brands and some of the world's smallest brands, but mm. people who really bought into a different way of thinking about their, not just their social, but just their marketing in general, and how they could use social as a really, really clever tool to unlock business growth.
So who would Vayner be up against? So like, which, if you were Mondelez and you were taking your brand out, who would be on that list that Vayner would be up against?
This is, I think, a really difficult question, and as one we've got at the Wild as well. Mm. And it's not difficult because we don't know. I think it's also a fascinating thing, because you can be an agency like Vayner or you can be an agency like the Wild, and you'll have such a broad competitive set mm. because you'll be up against different people at different times. So, you know, you might find yourself against kind of the core kind of social and digital agencies who are out there, but equally you'll be pitching against some of the big creative agencies yeah. who run kind of, you know, the full creative account, and actually you'll win the whole pie off them, not just the social digital bit. Yeah. Or you'll be against media agencies as well, or PR agencies who also offer social and influencer. It's such a messy, fragmented market, I think, right now. Yeah. It's not, we've moved away from those days of having a clear-cut competitive ATL, set where BTL, you know, yeah, yeah. And when you know you're always going to be up against, you know, the same three kind yeah. of thing in a pitch. It yeah. wildly varies.
So, okay, better question would be, what would have been a dream client? And what would be an example of like, oh my God, this is David and Goliath kind of situation. I can't believe we won them.
Well, I mean, they were a dream client. Well, all of them were dream clients. What am I saying? But I think our I think every sort of era of an agency has one transformative client, mm-hmm. I think, who comes in. And for us at my time at Vayner, that was TikTok. And TikTok was very, very kind of early days, kind of taking off in the UK. This was probably, 2019? Mm. Kind of, you know, and they were going on their own kind of growth journey as well. And suddenly being the agency who, yeah, we were making TikToks, you know, it's a really, really interesting thing. And I think it helped us mature as an agency as well, because I think there's always a really symbiotic relationship between kind of, you know, those sort of the big clients you have and the way you work with them and how you shape your business as well to evolve there for their needs as well. So that led us to, you know, that plus COVID led us to thinking in a really different way about how you overcome the issue of not being big enough to have, you know, big teams and offices in various different European markets. Mm. And it's actually, you don't need whole teams and offices. You just need the people, and you need the wherewithal to find the people and bring them into your processes and make sure that, you know, you're onboarding right, you're working with them right, and you're briefing them right. And actually that opened up a whole new way of thinking about kind of our business as well, which is all about casting people for the right kind of the right brief for the right clients, but also massively reducing cost and overhead, which you can then pass on to clients, which obviously makes you more affordable and gives the clients better value.
Did you feel that was quite a big part of the pitch, the value thing? Because particularly when it, you know, I would have looked at VaynerMedia from the outside and gone, okay, it's kind of media, creative content, social offering thing, not performance marketing, but almost like heading into that kind of category. Performance marketing is very measurable and it's really easy to track, or a lot easier than it is to do a big brand advertising thing. Did you find that there was a lot of nickel and dimey kind of, you know, approaching to pitches, or was it much more the proof is in the pudding of how we deliver these projects? How would
I think the latter. I think, I mean, value for any pitch always comes into it. Mm. And I think what's exciting is when you can start to reframe that, so you're not just on a time model basically of, you know, we will staff you this team or you know, x hours of creatives and strategists and everything else. And when you can actually start to move towards packaging things up on, in, well, ideally you go to value-based pricing, but I think the industry is still quite some way from that, and certainly in my experience, but really getting to that point where you're showing what you have and what you can provide and what you can deliver. Mm. And it's it really plays to your own areas of expertise as a business. I think we were talking about this a bit earlier, and sort of the, you know, the difference between, say, the brand and design industries and the advertising industries. And I think when you can actually have that confidence as an agency to say, this is what we do, this is what we promise, this is how we're going to deliver results for you, this is how we do it, come with us on that journey. It may be quite different to what you're used to and the way you're used to working with different agencies. I think that can actually be really successful and very, very appealing to a lot of marketeers who, you know, quite often can be pitching because they're a little bit frustrated with the same old that's not really working.
How dependent do you think it was on the Gary Vaynerchuk show? Was that a big part?
Oh, Gary's amazing. Yeah. And yes, I mean, obviously you can't have Vayner without Gary.
Yeah.
And I think it's, well, you will also understand this as a founder and entrepreneur, kind of, you know, that is a key kind of USP of the business. And I think I'm also made a decision when I was kind of looking for my next roles after Leo's. I wanted to go somewhere where we really had something genuinely unique and authentically unique to say. And always for Vayner, that's very much coming from Gary and his take on social, the industry, and his expertise and his brilliance at predicting and seeing what's coming and sort of understanding the world in a, you know, in a way that only he does. And ditto the wild, similar scenario. We've got something very, very unique. I think it's, there's so few ways to differentiate as agencies, because ultimately we're all creating a similar kind of work that ends up in a similar kind of channel. So it's either the people, it's either the fact that we are just so brilliant at what we do that we consistently kind of, sort of hit it out the park, or it's because we're based on something fundamentally kind of different as well. So Vayner and The Wild definitely both sit in those two camps of having something, you know, being founded on something different.
Yeah. How did that ever get in the, not in the way, but like, would there ever be a situation, because the way he comes across on social media is so kind of like quick and like fast decisions are made. And I guess that's fine when you're in a company of sub 50 and it's like, you know, you're like a speedboat. But that was it was quite a big company towards the end, right? It was like
huge,
500 people maybe. Is it that big or?
I'm bigger globally. Yeah. Thousands, yes.
Can a CEO that is like that still work like that? Or is did he kind of move into more of a sort of non-execy?
No, I mean, no, and it does work. It really, really does. And I think that's why I learned so much from working there, because it's such a different way of running a company. But the other thing that was really brilliant about Vayner, I think, because it's built on different values. So, and you'll know this from what Gary talks about, but, you know, really basing it on kindness, on respect, on kind of empathy, and you know, very, very, it's a very modern view of leadership.
Yeah.
And it leads to different ways of working and a different culture within the agency.
Can you think of an example that wouldn't have happened at Leobonnet that did happen at VaynerMedia? Through the lens of that new style of leadership?
I think there's probably a real sense of how to describe it? Closeness. There's a real kind of sense of, it's like any tribe or any kind of, you know, young new business. There's a sense of you're all working for the same thing. You're on a mission. Yeah. You're all in the same direction. It's all exciting. You're all feeding each other. You've got great personal relationships, you know, with people in LA or people in New York. And I think that's probably a really, really big difference as well in terms of just thinking about the sort of the globalism. Whereas if you work for a network agency, there'll be people that you know in different markets that you might have met on training things, or, you know, you've been at sort of big group meetings together, or you've worked on the same account together kind of thing. But just creating this very, very strong community across multiple countries and borders is, yeah, I think a real strength of Vayner's.
I want to get into now. Yes. Oh, okay. The Wild. So I, weirdly, went to college with the founder of Jungle back in the
day. Did you really?
Yeah, Jamie, yeah.
I did not know that.
Well, he was the year above me.
Oh, my God.
To be honest, I never knew how big it had got. I thought it was, because these were the days, right? Jungle Creation, Social Chain.
Yeah.
It was nothing then, it was something huge. It was like one of those things. We're like, what the hell? Oh, right, it's a real thing. So I've always, I was always fascinated by what it was and how it kind of worked. How was that position to you? So when you got the call and it was, right, there's this thing called The Wild at Jungle, how was that sold to you and what made you go, that does sound quite interesting?
Ooh, well, one, the amazing CEO, Melissa, was amazing. And so she immediately sold it to me, because I just, I remember getting off the phone to her from our first call, because I was also quite close to another role as well. And I went out to talk to my husband and like, this is really annoying. I really like her. I think this is the one.
No. And you don't want that to be the case.
No, it's like, why is this? It's like you're about to get married or something. And then you sort of meet someone. And you, why do I keep going back to these love analogies? I don't know. Work, love. So it was immediate. It was almost a bit of that immediate connection kind of just actually, I love what you're saying. I love how you think about it. This is incredible. And I really, really want to know more about it and really understand if this is the right thing for me. I think what really appealed, apart from her and kind of the, you know, what they'd achieved and obviously the incredible business that Jungle Creations is, was that, you know, this whole untapped kind of gold mine that is applying publisher data and insight to brands through kind of agency services, and this whole new proposition, which, you know, we just kind of unveiled yesterday with our new branding and website, which is all around, you know, us being a publisher powered social and influencer agency.
Just on that,
yeah,
because like there's, you're used to saying those words, but I'm hearing them for the first time. Publisher powered. Okay. Why is that good? What like, why is that a good thing to be publisher powered?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So we make around 500 bits of content, original content a month. We put it out across 8 of our different brands and channels, global audiences of 147 million. And if you think on each of those pieces of content, channels, platforms, etc., we are seeing how real people are responding to real unbranded content, which could be around different food recipes or, you know,
memes,
you know, different kind of, you know, what are people thinking about? What kind of pizza are people liking, kind of thing? What's trending in kind of plant-based eating kind of thing? Because we see literally what recipes of ours are trending, or what style of content, or, you know, what formats are working kind of the best, or what stopped working, which is as much a sort of an important thing as what is working, because we're keeping a pace and we're ahead of what's happening in terms of the algorithm and those changes. So the fact that we as a publisher have that relationship with platforms, and the fact we're putting out all this content, means we're seeing changes, trends, cultural behavior. Yeah, we're seeing everything before you normally get to see that as an advertiser or as a brand. So we can take all of that insight, and I see it as being about 5 steps up the food chain and shortcut a lot of that for our brand clients as well, so that we're not having to go through that kind of experimentation test, see what's working, see what's not on our brands, because we're already doing that on our media channels. So we can take all of that and apply it. And then I think there's a second kind of really big point to that, which is around knowing how to grow audiences and nurture communities. And that has been, as you say, you know, you go from here to suddenly being, you know, huge overnight, pretty much, or in the space of a year, because, you know, we know how to launch a video pod and get it from, you know, I don't know, sort of naught followers on TikTok to 600,000 or a million in a year. So all organically. So all of those principles about what are the tips and tricks, how do you use kind of formats and series, you know, what are the actual formats that are best at driving more engagement? How do you layer in a different form of community management? So it's much more about community experience, and how do you actually, you know, again, through practice, through learning, through having amazing people, how do we apply that to our brands? And how do we actually just deliver incredible engagement results and follower growth, you know, whatever their metrics are, through everything we've learned through being a publisher for 10 years?
Wow, okay. That was an amazingly eloquent answer to my kind of vague question. So that's
good, because I'm going to have to pitch that a lot over the next year. So I need to work on it. Thank you for asking it.
But okay, like, talk to me like I am a dumb person that I am. I'm imagining I'm going to try and use a brand that isn't one of yours. I was about to say Hellmann's, and I think that is one of your clients through Twisted. Perhaps probably is.
No, it's fine. We can talk about Hellmann's.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
So I'm Hellmann's. Now, I would have usually gone to Ogilvy for my brand work.
Yeah.
I would have gone, you know, there's a whole team in there, right? What is my user journey like as a client through the wild versus through Ogilvy?
Okay. That's a really good question. There are probably a few answers to that, because there are a few different routes. So one route could be, we love the big campaign platform that Ogilvy has developed. We've got an amazing budget that we're using on our paid media, but we want to actually extend it to different audiences. And we're really interested to see if giving a little bit of Twisted magic on our sort of partnerships would give us another level of innovation, of engagement, of fun, of talkability around our central campaign platform. And therefore, can we partner with Twisted on something? So that's kind of the that's the one cool route. Yeah. That's kind of probably the old route into kind of jungle. what we're also offering with The Wild is actually the chance to go, hey, why don't we work with Ogilvy? Mm-hmm. And we will take that campaign platform and we will show you how that should play out on social across all of your, well, through a mixture of organic and paid, through a mixture of, I don't know, experiential stunts, et cetera, and how we can actually just really expand and blow out the social element of your campaign. Mm-hmm. Because that's where people are really going to encounter it first and foremost. We all know we live through our phones. Mm. People, you know, are searching, Gen Z are searching more on social platforms than they use Google. Mm. So it's so important for, you know, you to have a consistent touch point with your audiences where you're showing up on their feeds in a way that actually they want you there. That's not just an ad cut down and put onto to Instagram, which sadly many people are still doing. So there's kind of that route. And so I think we work alongside big agencies or small agencies who are doing sort of different roles and part of that sort of ecosystem. So, for example, that's how we work very happily on Pucker. Mm-hmm. On other brands, actually, they will come to us, and I won't use Hellmann's or Ogilvy in this example in case they get upset. But they will come to us and say, actually, you know, we want a, you know, full funnel campaign. Can you do VOD? Can you shoot out of home for us? Mm-hmm. Can you come up with a fully integrated idea, mm-hmm. but one that is really rooted in social insight and cultural behavior? Because we know that's going to give us a better campaign, kind of, if we use that as our starting point, rather than just do the big broadcast transmit job, which is what should we be saying to people? And then we'll kind of tick off the boxes as we sort of go through to, you know, how does this show up on social?
What happens does anything ever unexpected happen in a good way? So does a client ever go, oh my God, I didn't think this was going to happen? Or like,
yeah.
What can you, I mean, I know you're new into the role, but has there been any situations where a client has gone, I didn't expect this to happen, thank you?
Yes, I mean, I think what's been quite exciting is when the work we do has opened up new avenues and new ideas, which then the business has taken on. Mm. And I'm not sure I can give you the example I've got in mind is the best one, annoyingly.
Doc Martens.
Okay, I'll pretend that they are Doc Martens. For the record, they are not, but they are. So Doc Martens were doing a very, very, very big high profile campaign around a big sporting event that they were, in a different country.
Oh, I can't think of anything. The Asian World Cup.
Yeah. Yes, this is going down some really weird metaphor routes, isn't it? We're going to get very tied up and in laces by the end of it.
Cease and desist, brilliant. Yeah.
So, and we've been running kind of the content for it and the social, mm-hmm. and one of our community managers kind of saw this consistent request for, oh, we love this, we want more of this, we want more of this. Mm-hmm. So actually at the event we then fed that back and it led to a whole content series being filmed kind of at the event and then put out, and has now given rise to kind of a new way of thinking about how Doc Martens covers various sporting events.
Wow.
So it's what I love about that is that it's the smallest insight that could have completely gone unnoticed or unmissed. But because we've got people who are so invested in the brand and so invested in the platform and understand how people behave on social and how to actually really, you know, turn followers into fans, that we've got people looking out for that and they can spot those. And then it's that ability to elevate it into actually what strategically makes sense for the brand to be doing, which can then loop back to its overall business goals as well.
Wow, that is different. Now, I get it now. Because you wouldn't, if I was in Titanic ship agency, big, huge beast, where I've got five different account directors, BDs, the creative team get 3 weeks to develop one concept for an idea that's going to be on a TVC that's going to be in 9 months' time. There isn't an organic moment. The timelines just aren't there for me to have a community person diving into the comment section of a recent campaign from Doc Martens. Even if I see something that's incredible and I'm like, oh my God, the fans are asking for this thing, feed that to the creative person.
Yeah.
9 months later, ad comes out and everyone's like, wow, what's that thing? And so that's interesting, because you could, theoretically, that this it should all be starting here.
Yes. Like,
I don't know why. Okay, I can understand longer-term brand building and that kind of stuff, but there's no reason why you can't do that. Where I think digital social agencies, particularly, you know, in the faster sense get a bad name where I don't think they deserve it is that it's transient.
Yeah.
But I think you can build deep-rooted brand
100%,
even if it is quick.
Yeah.
And if it's responsive, you know, that's really interesting. I didn't think about it from that perspective. I think that's where I get the mixed up a little bit, where I think brands they are now considering going to these agencies rather than a big lumbering Titanic.
And I think the penny has dropped that you can and should and do build brand on social, and that you absolutely need to build and nurture that community. And if you do that, then you can learn so much. You create super fans essentially, but then through use of media, through use of expanding out to influencers and creators, etc., then you can scale that reach. So actually, you know, it becomes quite unstoppable if you do it right.
Speaking of unstoppable, how how will you know? So I like to talk about objectives quite a lot.
Okay.
I get quite obsessive around objectives just because I feel like without them, what are we doing?
Yeah.
And not always financially, like you can have spiritual objectives around a culture. I always say when we're taking a briefing down for a CEO or a CCO, I don't leave until we know, okay, in the order, what are the objectives of this hire?
Yeah.
How do we know in a year's time if this is going really well?
Yeah.
And sometimes the number one thing is spiritual. It is like, this needs to feel like an agency with empathy.
Yeah.
Or this needs to, we need to have a culture of excellence that I can't put in an award or a can line or an account. We'll just know it.
Yeah.
And there's some stuff that you can't put your, you know, fingerprints on, you know, touch. But then other times it is clear, numeric, financial objective.
Yes.
Where do you have a clear objective? Do you have something in your head where you'll go, my work in this season for this role would be done? Or, you know, I know I would have done the thing I came here to do if I...
Yes.
Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do. It is all related to growth and reputation. Not purely, though, as you say, not purely for financial and commercial aims. I think we believe so strongly, and I believe so strongly, having worked for God knows how many decades in advertising, that our whole, you know, publisher power is a secret weapon to doing social marketing better and marketing in general, because it gives us so much more robust, exciting insight to build better work from. So we want people to get that actually publisher power, you know, is a thing actually, because no one is really talking about it or doing it, and we're not doing it for that reason. We're doing it because we've seen the results and we've seen the effects of it. So I want The Wild to be famous as a publisher powered agency, and for bringing in, you know, something new to the discussion and the debate about the best way to do things. Now, there will never be a best way, because obviously this industry loves to argue and everyone's got an opinion. But I want to throw something very, very exciting and something that feels very new and different to me into the mix. And I want us to win awards, and I want us to make amazing work for amazing brands, because that for me is the proof of our concept.
Could The Wild win
a can line?
No. Of course it can.
It already has.
Yeah, okay. Nice. Where are you? Nice. That's the clip, by the way. That's the clip. No, could you, and you might not want to win a Morrisons, but let's use Morrisons, probably an ex-client of yours at one point at Leo Burnett. Could you, it's a hard one because it's a big retail account, isn't it? But an account that is reported in campaign like that, a creative account, could... And would that be a goal of The Wild, to steal an account from a Widens or from like a Mother or something?
That would be lovely.
Okay, so that would be a way. Okay, so it's good to know, because I like,
yes,
you know, we speak about there being a variance of different competitors. Some are going to be like, you know, the Social Chain or We Are Social, or you could be at the other end of experiential with Amplify.
Yeah.
I don't know. We've not really mentioned much. We've spoken about kind of co-working on a campaign with an Ogilvy or a Leo Burnett or someone like that. What about not? And actually...
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And I'd say about... Our clients are probably 50-50 at the moment in terms of us working with another creative agency and us doing everything.
Okay.
And I think that will happen more and more.
Yeah.
I really do.
And that will slowly become 60, 70.
Yeah, I think it will. And look, there are always going to be brands and marketing teams and departments and CMOs who still want to have and need, you know, they may well need that kind of ecosystem of having multiple agencies and multiple disciplines.
Mm.
But I've noticed over the last probably three, four years that, and I do think the pandemic's got a large part to play in this as well as the maturity of agencies like The Wild and Vayner. Mm. But we are now seeing really big brands who are really happy working with really small agencies like us because they get better value. They get people who they really trust in social to really navigate them through it. And we do it in a way that isn't precious or territorial. And they get access to kind of more senior people rather than a kind of a, you know, the teams that they might get. They don't get lost, do they? And no good agency will ever let their clients feel that, you know, they're not important. But I think there is just a sheer numbers game.
Yeah.
You know, if you're with a small agency, you are really, really important to them.
Yeah.
And as you grow with them, then, you know, that relationship continues and endures. So I think that for me is a really exciting development in the shape of our industry over the last few years.
Yeah.
And I think that will make for better creativity all round because we always need to keep evolving and changing, and there needs to be space for new agencies to come along and grow up and bring something new and refresh the way we think about things and do things.
If we're in a year from now and all the good things have happened, all the plans, the rebrand, which you should check out, is live and it's like, wow, it's been received and people are backing this publisher power and they go, oh my God, that's actually really smart. And then what's different about The Wild in a year from now? If all the good things have happened, what's different to now?
I can tell you who Doc Martens really are. And
okay.
I'll be saying, and yeah, after that, Hellman's just came to us.
Yeah.
And it's like, we love Eagleby, but we want you as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it is,
no,
we want these big account wins.
Yeah.
And we want, because that unlocks more potential to do more stuff.
And,
you know, it enriches all the people that are working at the business.
Yeah.
To get better work done.
Yes.
And it's more predictability, right? It's less scrappy and projecty.
Yeah.
I'm
really proud over the last sort of year, we've already made a massive shift from, you know, probably what was the project work of the early kind of days of any agency of The Wild through to retained relationships that we're now getting into year 2, 3, 4 of as well. Because that to me is a real sign of a good agency as well.
Yeah.
It's easy to win, but it's not easy to keep.
Yeah.
So really making sure that actually, those relationships are enduring.
Mm.
And because also that's when you get to make the most business impact. And that's when you get to make the best work as well, because you know each other so well. We know the business inside out. And, you know, that shortcuts a lot of the, I guess a lot of the things that can cause friction in client agency relationships as well.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a good understanding of this now. I feel like I understand The Wild. The future.
Yes.
I've written in my little notes thing that I sent to you, the future of Adland, which I guess we're calling it Adland. We can call it Adland.
We should probably come up with a new phrase
creative
for it,
industry.
Shouldn't we?
Oh, God. Because I hate calling it Adland. That's a slur. It's like an old, I'm imagining like these fat cats in Madison Avenue, you know, like with a cigar, like, hey, welcome to Adland, you schmuck. But okay, we'll call it commercial creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Makes sense. It's not art, it's craft, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
You know?
Yep.
Difference.
Definitely not art.
Art is not to brief.
Mm-hmm.
Craft is too brief.
Yep.
Creative. Oh, that's not creative capital. Okay. Commercial creative.
Commercial creative.
In this land. What do you think is going to happen? We've got agencies consolidating. We've got VML, YNR, ABCD, EGP, all of them merging together. That seems to be happening. You know, everyone can kind of see that happening quite a lot. What do you think will happen in the next 2 years?
I think we will see a surge of... We've obviously got slight bias in what I'm about to say. But we'll see a surge of the smaller indies growing in significance and revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we will see more diversification between kind of the big groups and, or sort of more distance between the big groups and the likes of our kind of agency. I think we're all going to be muddling around with AI for quite some time, and people are going to waste a lot of money on trying things and new propositions and new shiny kind of decks that kind of say how much it's going to save their clients. And I think there's going to be a tussle over that. And I do think we're going to see the new breed of groups and holding co's kind of come through. And I think like any sector, we're just going to see the next wave of challenges and change. And I think, I hope, this is me being very optimistic, I hope it's going to raise the level for us all and raise the bar for everyone in every single sector. But I do think where I am now in this kind of small, indie, fast growing, very, very adaptable style of agency that specializes in social and digital, we are going to see kind of hopefully a lot of growth and us getting given and us earning actually more and more strategic responsibility for brands.
Yeah. I think it's really well put. And it, you wouldn't want to be going into this new world with a lumbering balance sheet. You know, we want this
no.
very weighty, hefty thing where you've bought a million companies, most of them do the same thing like that.
Yeah.
I completely agree with the nimble, agile, adaptable business. I think those are the ones that are going to be like, you know, you've got a Titanic that's trying to steer and you've got a speedboat that's going,
it's
bouncing from different ocean to ocean. Okay, I like that prediction.
Yeah.
One last question from me.
Oh, yes.
It's my last question. And it's more of a kind of reflective thing. And you can be as personal or you can be as non-personal as you want. It's more about the world we're in now. And if you were to meet Sarah Bauman that was 21 years of age. She's probably like at a party somewhere. Like, why are you talking to me? Go away.
You're grown up. Go away. You're really old.
So what would you say? What would you say to her if you were to?
Oh, my God. That's a killer question.
Oh,
that's really good. And one, bizarrely, I've never actually thought about. I think in the world of work and also life, I would really sit her down and give her a proper talking to and just say, it's kind of in the realm of if you don't ask, you don't get. But it's more about actually you are the only person who is really in a position to make any choices, who is in a position to make any choices about your future. So you need to be in control. No one else is going to advocate for you or as well as you. And you'll be surprised what will happen if you do ask and you do decide what you want and you ask for it.
Wow. Bang on.
Thank you. Sound like I was a really bad 21-year-old. Really meek.
Do not say yes.
Don't say yes.
I love that.
Yeah. I think it took me a while to figure that out in the world of work, actually. Yeah. And it's probably only since becoming a manager and a leader that you actually realize the relationship you have with the people who work for you. Yeah. And actually, I want people to be at my companies because they're having an amazing, fulfilling, rewarding, motivating sort of time of their career. And it's forming a really important journey or part of their journey. And I know it will end up somewhere else. You know, no one's going to stay with us for 20 years. You know, I made that mistake nearly and I got up just in time. It's not good for people, actually, I don't think, to do that. So having that kind of much more open relationship and discussion with your managers, your heads of department, your MDs, your CEOs about what actually you can give and what you want to get out of it and what's right for you and where you'll be best, I think is probably, the best advice I could have given my young self.
I love that. I feel almost compelled to bring up Wackle now because we haven't spoken about it. But I do think it's important that everyone knows that that thing exists because...
Absolutely.
It's been going for years.
100 years. We just did our centenary this year, last year.
I better ask you this. How would you describe it in a sentence? what Wackle is. Who's it for? Why does it exist?
It exists for everyone because we are campaigning hard to accelerate gender equality, and that benefits everyone. If I can get more specific in that, obviously it is very much obviously a support network, a club that supports women, promotes women, promotes young talent in the industry through talent awards and the talent festival, and obviously harnesses, you know, many of the incredible women in the industry who are also making a huge influence, not just obviously kind of in their own businesses, which a lot of them obviously are doing, but also through the impact that advertising and communications can have. Because if you think about, you know, the representation of brands, agencies, media owners, platforms, if everyone is committed to actually making sure that girls, women, and also by extension, you know, diverse communities are represented more accurately, more authentically, and, you know, given that space, then the impact, you know, on a broader cultural level is absolutely enormous. That wasn't a sentence, sorry. That was like a paragraph.
It was a paragraph. It was a great paragraph.
Yeah, it was definitely a paragraph. I'm quite wordy.
I'm really wordy, so that's fine. This is a hell for the, I mean, what's the word, concise of the people. If you were to... What's a CTA? So, like, if a woman in advertising communications is listening to this now, what are you asking her to do? Or a man, I guess, because you speak about this being
absolutely diverse. No, it's very much about allyship as well. Okay. And
because when you shared with me that you, the applications were open,
yeah,
as a man, I was like, that's amazing. I can share that with the women in my business, and I can say, you should all. And I think, you know, Molly signed up to it. What is that the major thing? It's to get people to sign up to this thing. Is that the major kind of call to action?
For new members, absolutely. Yeah. So every year we open and we have kind of, we invite more and more women to apply because, you know, it's a wonderful problem to have. But as kind of more and more women get to more senior roles, then, you know, there are more and more women who could be part of our mission and join the club. I think, you know, originally, probably back in the day, Wackle was seen as more of a, you know, group of women who probably, you know, congregated together as a smaller group within a very male-dominated industry. I think what has really changed over the last sort of, 10, 20 years of Wackle, and even more so over the last sort of few years when I've, you know, that I've witnessed as I've been a member, is just this focus on campaigning and activism. And, you know, a lot of the great campaigns and support that Wackle has put to things like Time 2 to drive out sexual harassment, things like, you know, at the moment, kind of we're campaigning hard on 50% CEO representation, which, you know, obviously kind of is, you know, helped by amazing allies like you. So it's being very specific about how we think we can help accelerate equality as well, and not just being, yeah, I don't know, a club that gets together to stay insular. We're very much out and about in the industry, kind of with our clients, and making sure that the work we make is also, you know, showing the best that we can show for younger women growing up, whether they're ever going to come into this industry or not. Everyone is affected by what they see in advertising. Yeah. And that's really, really important that we are all far more conscious about it. And I think we've made obviously amazing progress in that. When you look back at some of the ads from, like 70s blows my mind, kind of, let alone kind of the 50s and all of that. And the 90s. And now it's still going on, isn't it? But, you know, if you think we can also influence that, then again, that is doing something really positive for the role of advertising and the role of communications back into the world.
Thank you so much.
So come join, people.
Yes, come join. Okay, spread the word. Sarah, thank you so much.
Oh, thank
I really
you,
appreciate
Ollie.
It. This was super last minute from you. So, like, well done. You dived in and you've been amazing. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.